welcome to Inspired Island, where every episode we sit down with someone living an inspired life here on Vashon Island in Puget Sound. From world-class artists and musicians to chefs and business owners, our little rural island has it all. I'm your host, Grace McCray, a new full-time Vashon Island resident, and thank you for joining me on this journey to discover why Vashon is such an inspired island. Welcome back to Inspired Island. This is an episode I've been looking forward to for a while now. I'm excited to have Bill Moyer here with us in the studio. Bill is the executive director and co-founder of the Backbone Campaign, a national progressive movement building organization based out of Vashon Island. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you very much, Grace. I'm honored to be here.
Now, many of our listeners will be aware of the Backbone Campaign, but for those who aren't, could you describe the organization and what y'all do?
Yeah, well, a lot of folks are new to Vashon, and the kind of by the nature of our work over the last decade, I would not be surprised if people hadn't even heard of us. They like, who are those people who have the giant images in the Strawberry Festival parade? But other than that, you know, it would be understandable for people to have sort of missed us. You know, everybody loves Vashon for its quirkiness. And Backbone is one of these quirky things that came out of Vashon Island and the scrappy group of artists who helped co-found it. You know, after 9/11 and the Patriot Act and such, a group of us got together for monthly potlucks. And we're like, well, what can we do? What? And at that time, a lot of these folks were doing like giant puppets, Bill Jarko, Jim Farrell, Kath Dismay, Dune Now. And, you know, lots of great folks. Hans Nelson. I mean, we just had quite a crew. And we did giant puppets for some demonstrations in Seattle and right before the invasion of Iraq. And we started doing things like overpass bannering. We had this oil man leading us into disaster, which was, of course, true. And, you know, about a year or so into it, we're like, wouldn't it be funny if we made a giant backbone and we delivered it to the Democratic Party? Right from the beginning, we always connected the artful activism, as we call it, with policy. And so the, you know, backbone is a metaphor that is particularly resonant for me personally. I'll get into that. But it's really a great metaphor for personal courage. It's also a metaphor for how all the things we care about are connected. They're not just these isolated issues, even though that's kind of how government and academia treat them. You know, healthcare and education and transportation and breathing clean air. Those are all things that are kind of basic and they're all connected. If you care about one, you probably care about others. So anyway, it's been a great ride, and we've learned a great deal and been able to provide a lot of tools to a lot of people around the country and even in other places. Mm. A couple of years ago, I was in Scotland doing a kayaktivist workshop for change agents over there, and we have had banners on the Amazon River, you know, by people protecting their right to land and water there. So anyway, we've had a disproportionate reach for our size and our budget, and it's really thanks to Vashon Island for incubating us and supporting us in our initial efforts. And again, like we had a backbone platform, you know, that's still actually quite a great little document. Yeah. But yeah, you know, it's been a joy to be on Vashon, and I'm very grateful to the community that's enabled me to actually delve into the work that I'm very passionate about and that I've developed some expertise in.
When I think about social change, I think it's easy to think about the policies, the politicians, you know, people in suits making decisions. But when you really scratch the surface, I think art and creative expression has really kind of underpinned a lot of our major social movements over history.
Right, because we're not just changing policy, we're changing culture. Mm. And I think of it as this idea of political calculus. And politics is the art of the possible. And calculus, my scientist brother told me, is the mathematics of changing variables. So if calculus and variables, right? So our job as creatives and as change agents in any number of ways, really, is to shift the variables, to shift what's politically possible, to change the political calculus, to make our vision for the future something that is not outside the realm of political possibility, but it becomes a political necessity.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the campaigns that I've been involved in over the years, watching that as it happen has been quite instructive in terms of strategy and understanding things like grand strategy have been very helpful to me to help, I think, successful and have a long view on social change and transformation and just winning little campaigns here and there. Yeah, I guess I think it might be fun to also just share the little story about why Backbone is particularly resonant for me. So when I moved to Vashon in end of 89, beginning of 90, my folks had lived out here. They had moved out here after I left home. I was in Federal Way, living in suburbia, and I didn't love it. It wasn't great for me. And I had come there from a small town called LeConnor up north. So when I landed on Vashon, after some wanderings and adventures, I just felt at home. You know, I felt like, oh, I like going to the post office and saying hello to people and seeing the same people at the store. The scale of Vashon really appealed to me. So I lived in a trailer for a while with my brother. And then this person I was doing some work with, I worked with Donald Roberts, who was a contractor at the time, and building my mom's house and then other stuff. I met a woman named Patricia Hudson, who lived down across a kitty corner from Agron Park. She's no longer here or with us any longer, but Patricia is a great woman, and she directed the choir at Methodist Church, and I go on and on about how great she was. But anyway, she let me build a cabin on the back of a flatbed truck on her land in trade for like cutting firewood and clearing the trails and mowing stuff and starting a garden.
Very Vashon.
So Vashon. But it was like an early tiny house, you know, and okay. I just come from Vermont, where I knew this dude who had like workhorses, and he pulled his own little tiny houses on the chassis of like he had a barn and a shop and a kitchen. Anyway, so he'd pull them around with his workhorses, and then he'd go and do like sustainable logging for people. It was just amazing. So I was inspired by that. I made this deal with Patricia Hudson, and I got a truck from Spanaway towed onto the island. And then I had to learn how to like get it to run. And it was a 47 International. And so, yeah, anyway, a huge learning process and building a space, you know, a cabin. Again, a huge learning process, and actually really kind of valuable as a young guy trying to get some skills and working in construction and stuff, but also a way of establishing some equity. And anyway, long story short, which is everybody who actually knows me knows that I can just talk forever, but so I apologize ahead
good.
Of time. So anyway, one day I started to do music stuff again, and I do music with kids, building in like recycled aluminum chair, TV, and in the old days when we had TV, and I was doing this residence, and I got done, and I went home to watch the sunset, and I climbed this tree next to my garden, and I got up there, I'm watching the birds flit, you know, about on the treetops, and I love being at the top of trees, and I was watching the sun go down, the crows flying back and forth, and I really was inspired by like, wow, this is beautiful. I'm really part of nature, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. You know, getting pretty, having my hippie moment, and then I'm like, oh, it's about time to get going, and I stepped down, and a branch broke under my foot, and I lost my grip. I was way at the top of this like 50, 60 feet up in this fir tree.
No.
Yeah. And I fell backwards.
No.
Yeah. It was horrible. And I didn't have a chance to really be scared. I just had this idea flow through my head. This like, this could be it. And then boom, I'm on the ground. And I'm like, well, obviously I lived. And my arms weren't broken. My legs weren't broken. I could move those. And I wasn't skewered or anything. But then I tried to get up and I couldn't do it. I didn't have any connection between what I wanted to do, my vision of like getting up and walking away, and my capacity, my body, capacity to actually do that. And so, luckily, my buddy Donald Roberts came over to visit me right at that time. He found me. He ran back. I was able to call out for help about three times before the blood was constraining my lungs and my capacity to breathe. And so Donald and then Susie came out and stood with me, and then Jason from a volunteer fireman came at EMT. Anyway, Stan Horan put a flutter valve in my chest. All this stuff happened and I got airlifted to Harborview. But that moment being on the ground has become for me a metaphor of the difference between having a good idea and having the capacity to manifest that idea. And the difference for me was backbone. And it's what I think of as a metaphor now for social movement and that natural coalition of all those things that people care about and the values that unite them being synchronized and connected with each other, because social movement power is relational power.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's and honestly, we didn't like think about that when we started Backbone Campaign. It took me months to realize that, oh yeah, this thing is kind of resonant, but
wow,
I've stuck with it. I love that metaphor and I love how it still resonates for me on my journey.
Yeah. Cause a good idea is still just an idea unless you can act on it. Yeah.
Unless you can act on it, and you can't really ever really make change on your own.
Yeah.
It does take, yes, a small group of people can make a big difference, but really those people in order to take on the collusion between corporate and elected power, you've got to be able to find alliances that can have the power to shift the political calculus. You've got to be able to shift what's politically acceptable for elected officials. One of the transitions we made in this learning process was to go from concentrating on things that were national issues like world peace and et cetera to where is the collusion between elected and corporate power impacting communities? Because where it's impacting communities, those are the places that people live. Those are the places that people love. And those are the campaigns that can make a material difference in people's lives. And therefore, where you could spend your whole life trying to get it on the front page of the New York Times, you could spend a gazillion dollars putting an ad in there and never actually make a bit of difference on the thing you care about. Whereas if you can mobilize a community for saving a place or stopping a harm, you can be addressing that same fundamental corrupting influence in society and actually deliver a victory.
Mm.
And delivering victories matters.
Yes. Yeah. They build to greater change. Yeah, I totally see that. It's those place-based campaigns that are often, yeah, you get a community banded together and it's amazing what they can do. Yeah. And I've got so many questions about Backbone, but I'll try to coalesce around a couple. But one of mine is going through deeper on the website. I loved the theory of change idea that Backbone coalesces around, because right, like so much, you could do so much. Could you talk about the lens of a battle between paradigms and sort of the paradigm shift that Backbone thinks is necessary and how that impacts your work?
Well, I'm glad you picked an easy question. So I guess that this really builds on this political calculus idea and the idea that change agents are also shifting culture, not just policy. One of the things that I think is striking about the moment that we are living in currently is that it's a populist moment. And populism can have a variety of expressions. I believe that the collusion between corporate and elected power is corrupting and is counter to the public's interests and our long-term good. And it tends to do something that is sort of paradigm defining, that kind of corruption. It puts a price tag on our water, on our places, on our time, on our food system, on our health. And it transforms us into a commodity and our lives into commodities. And I think it's very legitimate for people to rise up against that, to not be satisfied with mere competence in government. Or it's, you know, we wanted change, we could believe. We got competence. We got eloquence. But we didn't really get change. We had that, you know. So I understand the impulse that people have for change right now. And I just think that what breaks my heart is that what we see is a populism that appeals to the worst in people, when I believe that we could have a populism that appeals to the best in people. We were out over the freeway overpass in Seattle, over I-5, last week with a banner that says, "Immigrants make America great." And tomorrow we're going to have that banner at a different location, and we're going to have another banner that says, "Who would Jesus deport?" And I, you know, I've been looking at immigration and what it takes to come here legally and how difficult that is now versus a lot of us who were like, have been here, families have been here for 100 years or more, that, you know, it was pretty easy to get here then. It was pretty much a boat ticket, especially if you're from Europe and especially Northern and Western Europe. So the idea that we would punish people who are trying to make their lives better, and I would just like to get to the root of this. And I think that's to divide and conquer. I don't think that I think that's to mobilize people to create, to accentuate polarization. And I'm just not into that. I think we need to be finding what we have in common in order to take on what I think is a much bigger fight, which is the collusion between corporate and elected power. Yeah. And I really feel like it's a time now where we need to look at the grievance that people have that's legitimate and try to find ways to claw that back to appealing to what's best in them rather than what's worst in them. So the theory of change really is that the paradigms are really about a paradigm in which everything's for sale, that we have made inequality a kind of sacrament and sign of spiritual achievement, and the other side of that, which is that nothing actually of real true value is for sale. And so those things, that's kind of the realm of the sacred. It's what's beyond price. And I think that when, to the extent that we can engage in our change making from a place of defending that's kind of an unassailable, that puts us in a place of defending what's unassailable. And people who attack the defense of the unassailable, they weaken their power. They look like jerks. So it, you know, I have a Pentagon, former Pentagon strategist who's my strategy mentor and has been for the last 20 years.
Cool.
And he's 81 years old, and I had lunch with him in DC and Virginia actually a couple weeks ago, and we talk about these things. But it's grand strategy from the Colonel John R. Boyd, and that sort of framework. It's kind of an updated art of war approach. I find it extremely valuable, and I think that part of my life's work is to adapt some of those ideas for nonviolent social movement.
I really appreciate you talking through those paradigms, because I think many amazing thought leaders have talked about the importance of having a framework for making all these decisions and for guiding the strategy and guiding the tactics, et cetera. Yeah. So that's really a helpful way to think about it. And
I think frameworks are very helpful, right?
Yeah.
Because we're engaged in lots of things that could be just repeating the same old thing.
Yeah.
And if we have a framework we can understand, like it's strategic to build alliances, increase the cohesion of our allies, and deepen the resolve of our people it's strategic to undermine the alliances of our opponent, decrease their cohesion, and instill doubt. Mm. And the last part of main principle of grand strategy is that you want to win without sowing the seeds of future conflict.
That's a big one.
We're not just on this teeter-totter of power.
Yeah.
We're actually trying to deliver a future that other people see themselves in. And that's why I think our Solutionary Rail project is so important, because it's trying to present a solution that provides the infrastructure for the kind of society where we can reestablish value in the things that really shouldn't be for sale, this and the values of community, connectivity. But I'm getting down prematurely down another path. So you can, whatever, do whatever with that.
No, that's really helpful. And rail is on my list of things to bring up just because I'm so curious about it. Could you talk a little bit about Solutionary Rail and what the genesis of that program within Backbone Campaign is?
Yeah. And, I might cheat a little bit here.
Sure.
And share that, that part of that shift from working on national subjects to working on local subjects came because as we were doing all that national stuff, somebody called me up, and said, "Bill, we need Backbone. We're going to go and occupy a barge that's building a pier at Maury Island." And I'm like, "Huh, Charles, I think you should just back away and let's just think about that, because this is post 9/11 time period where that's piracy and domestic terror." I don't think that's necessarily. We should think twice. So anyway, it was the battle to save Maury Island that really confirmed for me the power of connecting to the places and that people love and the power of local campaigns. So I love to take walks at the Bluff, but that place was going to be an industrial gravel mine. That place was going to be, either, at one point when people first started fighting it, it was going to be the gravel that built the third runway at SeaTac. And then it was going to be gravel that got barged down to California for projects, or et cetera, et cetera. People worked on it for 10 years before I got that phone call. And it was a really great example of the multiple prongs of a campaign, mm-hmm. where people are doing legislative work, people are doing legal fights. And we came in at a time when there really wasn't a publicly facing aspect of the campaign. And so we did bring what we were learning about giant banners and mm-hmm. flying banners and direct action and it was the first time we used kayaktivism or on the water activism. And so we went from tricking Cairo in the days of traffic helicopters, prior to whatever they use now. We got the traffic helicopter from Cairo to swing over next to Sandy Shores because we had a banner, these giant 8-foot letters on the beach that said "Island for Sale" and then said "Sold Out" over it. And we had just taken the stuff that you wrap lumber piles with and we cut letters out of it. Anyway, and then we had a little training on nonviolent direct action, and then we blockaded two roads leading to the construction site. And there were brave people out there at 4 o'clock in the morning with these barrels that are partially filled with cement and locked down and blockading the way. And so we got onto King 5 News. And then we ended that because the police were like, "Well, we don't have the capacity to arrest 10 people out here. What do you want?" It's like, "Well, we'll disband and we'll call it good." And yeah. So we advertised that, okay, in 3 days, we're going to have a march on the beach, and which we had in the plans already. And so that month earlier, when we had about 30 people at Sandy Shores, a couple days after the people who were willing to risk arrest, we had 500 people on the beach.
Wow.
And all of a sudden, we were the poster child for saving Puget Sound. And this was embarrassing for the governor who had started the Puget Sound Partnership but wasn't getting squat done.
Yeah.
And so we had made it politically toxic, and we continued to campaign. We had people who helped organize the WTO protests and come out and do a training, the Ruckus Society. on Vashon. John Sellers, who lived here for a while, was a founder of Ruckus Society and had been involved in the WTO protests. So, and we told the governor's office, who had refused to meet with us, et cetera, that we're going to do this, and no, we weren't going to tell them when, and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so we had this, so we did this escalating campaign that just got to a place where the electeds and the courts, other victories started to happen. And it became politically unfeasible for this project to go through. And from the great work of the acquisition flank, which was Tom Dean at the Land Trust, figured out how to bring the funds together so that we could, so that the state would, and work with the county, et cetera, to purchase that land. And that's why we can take amazing walks and look at Puget Sound and Mount Rainier and this gigantic stretch of beach. And there's that, you know, derelict old relic of a previous generation of mining that exists there. But that's why we can do it, because the people in this community joined together in multiple ways. Amy Carey had done incredible work. Sharon Nelson had done incredible work. Lots of people did lots of work for lots of years. Backbone came in, did our piece, and together, all together with everybody else, we delivered a victory to this community, which actually resulted in other victories, like the creation of the bringing of the credit union and lots of and other things. So victories beget victory.
Mm-hmm. And it shows, the strength of the community. And now to stand there and in the peaceful, you can barely hear anything except sometimes there, the planes going to SeaTac, and then endangered whales pass by. It's wild. Thank you for being involved in that and all the hundreds of people around Vashon who were part of it. And going back to Solutionary Rail.
Right. Solutionary Rail. So, you know, I mentioned grand strategy.
Yes.
And, you know, the most important thing is to create allies, is to expand alliances. So when we were fighting, the Backbone campaign was involved in fighting this efforts to expand fossil fuel exports through the Pacific Northwest. It was the Cherry Point facility. There was other crude oil facilities. There was then, so there were coal trains were an issue, and then oil trains. And, you know, this is a place we love. And the idea that there would be accidents in the Salish Sea or in the, you know, along the Columbia River was an easy way to mobilize people. But so I saw a railroad labor guy on a panel in Seattle, and he was sitting next to Peabody Coal and BNSF Railroad. And I went up to him afterwards and I said, "What do you think? You know, do you really think this is the highest use of this railroad? And what about labor collaborating with Peabody Coal? That doesn't really feel right to me." And he said, "I don't trust these guys much as far as I could kick them. And if it was up to me, the railroads would be nationalized." And I'm like, wow, this is someone to circle back with. And I did circle back with him. And eventually he gave me this paper from 2008 about modernizing the Northern Transcon, which I didn't even know what that was. But it's the rail corridor from Chicago to the Puget Sound.
Okay.
And nothing had happened with the paper. And so he said, "Why don't you see if you and your people can green this? To green it, you know,
greenify
it, right?" So because of grand strategy, because of the importance of taking an active opponent and have the possibility of turning them into an active ally, that's a pretty unusual opportunity. Mm-hmm. And so I took it really seriously. I built a little team of experts who actually knew something about railroads when I knew nothing about railroads. And I started like talking to railroad workers around the country and people who were into like rail electrification and transmission and the idea of co-locating high voltage transmission on rail corridors. I don't know, people who are following like transition of renewable energy to renewable energy or just energy resilience in this country will know that we have three grids, you know, the Eastern grid, the Western grid, and the Texas grid, and they don't talk to each other really. And so if there's wind blowing in Iowa, but not in the Pacific Northwest, there's no easy way to get that wind energy to the Pacific Northwest or vice versa, not efficiently. And so we had this, we put out this book. It took us 3 years because we were doing other stuff too, like fighting Shell. But Anyway, we put out this book called Solutionary Rail that has really a different approach. It's not just like a technical book. It really tries to look at each sector. Like, what are the farmers' interests? What are the interests of the tribes? What are the interests of the workers? What are the interests of the communities that live around rail yards? You know, what are people who care about climate's interests, et cetera? And that honestly was just the very beginnings. We've learned so much more since then, since we published in 2016. Now that guy, Mike Elliott, is a strong collaborator. We work with railroad workers around the country. We work with the workers who run the plant in Erie, Pennsylvania that makes rail cars. They have a green locomotive program. We work with the Environmental Justice Coalition, the Moving Forward Network, of people who are impacted by diesel emissions from the freight system.
Yeah.
And so anyway, you know, we're exploring further, digging into rural connections. We've been working around the issue of Southeast Washington and the potential for expanding rail service to provide alternatives to farmers who are dependent upon a highly subsidized barges along the Columbia River, around the Snake River. So anyway, it's really expanded. And honestly, in the last year, it's been kind of nutty. Like, I know, I mean, it's just, we helped shape and write and edit the rail action plan that the Biden administration put out at the end of their. So we went from this thing that's on the fringes to something that's kind of in the gravitational center of thinking around policy, rail and power, both electric generation and transmission policy, but also rail transport. And we've been working with Markey's office, Senator Markey's office from Massachusetts, on the All Aboard Act, and it has lots of components. So when you look at these, if you go to our website, you know, solutionaryrail.org, that project, you'll see all these things that are like, and if you read them, they're like, that looks a lot like Solutionary Rail. It's because it is a lot like Solutionary Rail.
Wow.
So now I'm really focused on how do we take this moment, this populist moment, how do we use rail and our growing understanding of how the last 45 years of neoliberal policies of globalization and offshoring and deregulation and privatization and consolidation, how those intersect with rail and rural places and working class people whose small industries were left behind by these transnational corporations, and how family farms were made unsustainable and as a business in rural places, and what that did to small towns, even towns that, you know, like Colotus, Washington, or Washtenaw, Washington, and how do we use what we're learning about infrastructure, what an infrastructure actually literally means, what's happening underneath the structure, the underlying structure, and have conversations about a kind of legitimate grievance of being left behind, of being commodified, of having our land and our communities dismantled and undermined in service of a project that just concentrates wealth and power amongst a very few at the expense of everyone else. And so I want to protect and defend the places and people I love and have an appeal to the best in people with banners like we were talking about. But I also want to reach out and see if we can claw back some of that populist energy, folks who might have a little buyer's remorse in regards to when they see these tech billionaires getting the front row seat and Main Street kind of nowhere to be seen, and see if we can build social movement that shifts the political calculus in a different, more positive direction.
I'm just having a visual of, you know, train tracks being kind of a backbone to some of these broader changes.
Well said. I might steal that one from you, but I think you're right. And also, if you think about it as a circulatory system, the difference between now and like 1970 is that we've lost 70,000 miles of railroad. another 40,000 miles of rail approximately has been spun off. So these branch lines that used to serve communities are no longer required to be serving communities. They're unregulated. They're slow. They can't. It's like the wheat farmers in Southeast Washington. They are dependent upon Union Pacific and BNSF. They have to build trains that use their cars and their locomotives, and they have to build them that are 100 cars long.
Yeah.
Instead of having a country elevator that is served by a local railroad that comes by and picks up 4 or 5 cars of wheat and brings it to the co-op or brings it to port, we don't even have that option right now. And that's mirrored and repeated. That pattern is consistent across the country. And it's like the whole circulatory system was pruned to fit and serve a globalized supply chain that doesn't really care about Main Street America. And that's why we have chronic depopulation, and we have, you know, the insane concentration of power in our agriculture system,
yeah,
and our food that we eat. This, the corporate control of these systems, is really mind-boggling. And people who want change, who want to throw, you know, didn't get change they could believe in a variety of other ways, you know, maybe they're desperate and they want to see something happen. And so they threw their lot in with a shyster, a con man and whatever. But without getting into that, I think we could do more. I think we have more in common than we have that separate us. And I'm committed to appealing to that.
Well, thank you for going over that. And I'm catching the bug just by hearing you talk about, especially like solutionary rail and some of these like tangible opportunities that we have where, you know, you don't have to think of something new. It's about revamping something that has been existing for hundreds of years and can envision and feel right, like they have some sort of connection to.
We even actually have some memory still, barely, of when people had multiple trains a day in cities, you know, that where you could go from Ellensburg to Seattle and back in a day and do your business and then come go back, or go to the doctor and go back. And, you know, people want that. And people, whenever they go abroad, they come back like raving about the rail service and how fun it was and how great it was to ride trains. And it's so, you know, it's not like Americans don't love trains. Americans do love trains, but it's been decided for them that they can't have them. And I think that people are, our job is partially to wake that up and say, no, that's not okay. We don't need to reinvent the wheel, because the wheel is still a very excellent technology.
Mm.
We don't need to reinvent rail, because rail is a very efficient and very important technology, and not just because of decarbonization or climate. And so, you know, we don't need to jump on bandwagons that are super expensive for like these ultra high speed, blah, 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 bullet trains, when what we really need is just access to the damn tracks that we built with the railroads 170 years ago, and they had a common carrier obligation to provide service. We bailed them out when we created Amtrak. But they were supposed to provide preference, access to track, and faster speeds to passenger rail. Anyway, I won't get into the weeds on that, but people should check out our podcast, Reconnect America.
Yes, I could talk to you for a long time on that, but in true Inspired Island fashion, I'd love to bring the spotlight back to you a little bit. And you talked about how you got to Vashon, but where did you grow up, and how did the world of activism and art and thinking out of the box come to you?
Well, probably from, you know, damage. I was probably deeply damaged. I'm half joking. I grew up Catholic, but I have a lot to be thankful for that. But my mom was a nun, and my dad had studied 9 years to become a priest in the Jesuits. And they both had their intersections with indigenous people around this area. And so I grew up in a young family. I'm the oldest. And so they were hopping around doing one contract and one grant thing after another, from reservation to reservation across the Pacific Northwest. So I was born on Yakima. My brother was born when we lived in Spokane. My other brother was born when we lived near the Flathead Reservation. My sister was born when we lived at the Swinomish Reservation. So the damage, I actually think, is all that moving around. Mm-hmm. Holy moly, that was crazy. So it's like when I landed on Vashon, I'm like, I'm good. I'm good. I'm staying. You're going to have to carry. If I leave here, it's in a box. But and I don't even plan on that. But I do think that the positive values of sort of a progressive Catholicism, the preferential option for the poor. We would go to mass in Tacoma at a street drop-in center because my mom's such an incredibly principled person. And I would grew up, you know, going, seeing racism against indigenous people as we were exposed to I'm going to say Indian because that's what Indians call themselves, an Indian country, whatever. Native American culture, I was exposed to that and exposed to folks. It wasn't very long after the boarding school time period that I was meeting people who had been in the boarding schools. So I saw the pain. I saw the alcoholism too and understood this. I feel like I, even as a little kid, understood some of the source of that despair. And went to a lot of funerals as a kid because of that. So I think that the Catholicism, the growing up around indigenous people, growing up as a fourth generation Washingtonian who deeply loves this place and reveres the connection of this amazing inland sea, saltwater sea between two mountain ranges, you know, and growing up amidst the ferns and the huckleberries and, you know, the fir trees and climbing trees, for better or for worse.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I when I landed on Vashon, I'm like, I'm staying, right? So I've been very blessed to be able to be part of a community of also artists, the Umo family, extended family of my wife was a co-founder, Esther Edelman, is the co-founder of Umo. And so that's become my family, and we all had kids around the same time, you know, over the years. So those have been each other's cousins. We get together for Thanksgiving and Christmas to celebrate together, and we go and we still perform together every year at the Oregon Country Fair. We do a summer show. So I feel almost too lucky to have this life, do what I love around people I love in a place that I love, and to be constantly learning.
Well, I'm so grateful that you came and chatted with us today, Bill. We end every show with a little lightning round of questions. Would you be game?
Oh, okay, of course.
All right. Well, the first question is, do you have a favorite beverage on Vashon?
Well, Anurana's has a Nepali chai that's just out of this world. So that's my favorite beverage, I hands down.
Beautiful. If you're not at home or work, where can people most often find you on the island?
Well, you know, ironically, although I still love Liza Bula. I love Facing West. You know, I love that. But I really love the walk at the Bluffs. Mm. You know, Esther and I go and take a walk pretty much weekly over there. And I just love getting to see the Puget Sound and see Mount Rainier and the Cascades and then walk along that beach, and it's, you know, extra sweet when you know it could have been a whole other thing.
Yes. Yes, now all of our listeners have extra backstory, too, to enjoy next time you're walking on the Bluffs. And do you have any pet peeves about island living?
This is a tough one. When I moved here, there was still a bowling alley.
That's a great one. Okay.
And it kind of bugs me that you can't go out unless you're sitting. I love the movie theater. I love going to the movie theater, but you can't have conversations with people. And if you go to a performance, which we have some great performance, I mean, you certainly couldn't get down on the art scene here, right?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. We don't even have to leave the island anymore. But things like a bowling alley where people of all ages could come together in a, you know, safe and fun place to do an activity where you can have side conversations. To me,
yeah,
that seems like a no-brainer. Like, why wouldn't we do that?
Something you can do year-round, too, no matter the weather.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And what about these poor kids who grow up? You're like, I'm all excited because I landed here after my adventures. What about before you get to have all those adventures, you know? It's like, I think a bowling alley would be a really cool thing for Vashon.
Yeah, nobody's Nobody said that before, but I think that is a great one. And it's a business opportunity for someone here.
Exactly.
Do you have a favorite Vashon Island tradition?
Well, I have a new favorite Vashon Island tradition over the last number of years. I think the stupid bike night is about the coolest thing ever. I mean, I'm really praying that we can get fire back involved. But, you know, it always did scare me to watch when I was watching them and that go under those power lines and, you know, the fire balls go up. I'm like, okay, there might be a need for some rules or like protocols, please. But other than, you know, for the last couple of years, I've gotten to play percussion on a bike and be the drummer for Stupid Bike Night.
Cool.
And as a lifelong percussionist and drummer who doesn't nearly get enough time doing that, that's super fun. And that's my favorite tradition.
I'm going to look out for you next time. And lastly, where can people find you to learn more about you and your work?
Well, thank you. You know, it's pretty easy. Backbonecampaign.org is where you can learn how to get involved in the artful activism stuff. We really are, we're in a growth moment. We just hired a couple new staff. And so we're starting like weekly builds at our warehouse space. We have a space that was donated to us at the Sheffield building, a warehouse space and office. So thank you to the Bangasser family for that. And so, you know, physically you can come and join us there. And then, and then solutionaryrail.org is the other place. And there's links to our podcast, the Reconnect America podcast, which I'm super proud of. We're not like a foundation supported organization. We really rely on the generosity of people and mostly individual donations. And we have this thing called the Lumbar Club, you know, jamming on the theme of the lumbars. You know, I shattered T12, L1 and 2. So the Lumbar Club keeps us going. And yeah, so we really do need folks to contribute in various ways, because that's the only way that we can have the capacity to make the kind of scale of change and show up in the manner that we desire and envision showing up in a generous way around the country for people at a really important moment.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Bill.
Thanks for the opportunity. I'm really grateful.
And thank you so much for listening. Again, this is Inspired Island on Voice of Vashon, KVSH LP Vashon, your listener-supported island connection. Until next time, stay inspired.